Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I have a special fondness for the television series Minder, as in the 1980s, I lived close to one of the series' most iconic locations. You can see it as the opening credits roll. Cockney conman Arthur Daly's rundown second-hand car lot. A pivotal setting for many comic escapades, where the lovable rogue Arthur conducts shady deals in search of a nice little earner. Deals that frequently land him in trouble with the old Bill. I never imagined that this very spot would become the stage for a dramatic episode of my own. It began at the end of a sightseeing spin with my parents in the summer of 83, when I was pulled over right outside Arthur's car lot by a police car containing two of London's finest, a dour-faced sergeant and an equally unsmiling inspector. Granted, my car had seen better days. Even Arthur might have hesitated giving it space among his stock of well-abused motors. But these officers approached as if it was a foul-smelling beast, and a contagious one at that. Anti-Irish sentiment was evident in certain quarters at that time, but I hadn't directly been on the receiving end until I saw the sergeant stop theatrically at the Ireland badge with its tricolour emblazoned on the front grille of my canary yellow Cortina. I felt it added a certain diplomatic quality as I ferried my parents around. The sergeant, however, made it clear the colour scheme was not to his liking, as he leaned his flushed face uncomfortably close to mine and queried, "Been drinking, have we, sir?" Simultaneously, the inspector whipped out a breathalyzer and, with the finesse of a seasoned fisherman netting a prized catch, positioned it precisely under my nose. "Take a deep breath," he instructed, "and blow until I tell you to stop. If the result shows negative for alcohol," he pointed, "this light will go out." I blew with confident gusto and waited for the dying of the light. To my dismay, the glow remained distressingly well lit, a state the now chipper sergeant was convinced I was in as he cheerfully escorted me to the police car. Windows in the vicinity rattled open in a symphony of shame as neighbours joined my bewildered parents in watching the lawbreaker being whisked off to the nick. I was in a daze. What had just happened? I'd tested positive. Surely the breathalyzer must be faulty. Then the penny dropped. Near the end of our excursion, we'd had lunch in a pub where my father had a whiskey, improbably called sheep dip. Out of curiosity, I took the tiniest of sips, barely enough to wet my lips, but evidently enough to trigger the inspector's breathalyzer. They must have observed me drive away from the pub and followed. As I worried and waited to be tested by the station's more sophisticated intoximeter, the inspector read aloud my details. "He's a teacher," he scoffed. The sergeant laughed. "Oh yeah, what does he teach?" "I teach English," I interrupted, "among other things." "That's funny," sniggered the sergeant, "an Irish bloke teaching English." Their mockery cut deep. "What's so funny about that?" I asked. "Well," he said, his tone emphasising that such an oxymoron should be obvious even to a moron like me, "an Irish bloke teaching English." My blood boiled, but as the mouse in their lion's den, I had to confront this prejudice without making things worse for myself. "I can't see how that's funny," I said as reasonably as I could. "What would be funny is an Irish teacher who couldn't educate others in English, considering how many literary masterpieces in the language have been written by Irish authors." I launched into as many examples as my fevered brain could unearth. "I'm sure you're familiar with Gulliver's Travels," I asked, "by Jonathan Swift, an Irishman. The Vicar of Wakefield, by Oliver Goldsmith, an Irishman. Waiting for Godot, by Samuel Beckett, Irish. Dracula. Dracula? The sergeant exclaimed in recognition. By Bram Stoker, I said. Irish. Castle Rackrent by Mariah Edgeworth. Irish. I was hitting my stride now, and with the Irish RM also a hit on television at the time, I added its writers, Somerville and Ross, to my roll call. And of course, I continued, you'll surely know the most famous novel of them all, Ulysses by James Joyce, also Irish. I was about to embark on the Ulster canon of Heaney, Freel and Longley when a shot of a different nature rang out. Game on, the sergeant barked, pushing me towards the large machine. With a look of malevolent anticipation, he commanded me to blow into the tube. His expression turned to puzzlement when my first attempt failed to provide the desired outcome. The now highly irritated inspector recalibrated the machine and ordered me to blow harder and longer the second time. Now, I don't know what it feels like to score the winning goal at an All-Ireland final, and I never will, but I'm willing to bet it doesn't come close to the jubilation I experienced when that breathalyzer registered its final verdict. Nul point for alcohol. You're free to go, the inspector snarled. I bid the pair a cheery good day, cheekily inquiring, I don't suppose, gentlemen, there's any chance of a lift back to my car. Their furious reaction indicated it was time for a hasty exit. So I skipped lightly into the sweet-scented fumes of West London's rush hour. Back at Arthur's car lot, I slid into my Cortina. I glanced over at Arthur's office, half expecting to see him there, cigar in hand, saluting me for getting won over on plod and uttering those immortal words. The world is your lobster, my son.
The middle of November, in Japan, in Okayama, and we go walking in the persimmon orchards that edge the city. November is the time of year to visit Japan. The air is warm and the sky is blue, but the nights are cool and the steam heat of a Japanese summer is over. And on this calm afternoon in Okayama, the road climbs into the hills so that we have a view of what already, after just a few weeks in Japan, seem like familiar landscapes. Dry rice paddies, green fields, forests touched with red and gold, and pale hills in the distance. And all around us, the persimmon trees are fruiting. The persimmon is a beautiful fruit, heavy for its size and brightest orange and lusciously sweet, and with a sturdy, glossy skin, meaning it can travel the world in perfect safety. Persimmon trees grow across East Asia, in Mexico and Brazil, in Spain and the United States. Persimmons from China made their way across the sea to Japan a millennium and a half ago. But it hasn't yet become so very familiar a fruit to me. I might buy a persimmon or two from time to time in the Asian shop around the corner from us in Dublin, and we'll slice them and eat them for breakfast. But no, not familiar, exactly. Slice them and eat them, but the truth is, I wasn't sure exactly what else to do with them. Here in Japan, in Okayama, it's another story. In this sunny corner of the country, every house has a persimmon tree growing in its garden, and every boy is heavy now with bright fruit. Nobody in Japan feels nervous of a persimmon. Here and there, a stepladder is placed by the trunk of a tree, and soon persimmons will be hanging to dry from the deep eaves. You can stew a persimmon, you can make delectable jam, Or you can enjoy hoshigaki, the sweet dried persimmon that is a Japanese delicacy. Or, as in medieval Japan, you can deploy the persimmon in your love life by writing a love poem on a persimmon leaf by the water's edge and setting it to float away on the stream. In the orchards of Okayama, we see many people at work, and at the orchard gates, boxes of persimmons ready for market. And something else. After a few minutes, we see that most of the people are old or aging. We know about Japan's demographic crisis, its shrinking population, the movement of its young people to the cities, the emptying of the countryside with few young hands to bring in the crops. Impossible not to know about it as we move around Japan and see the empty houses and gardens gone to seed on street after street. And now, another element of this emptying land, as we see that many persimmons will rot on the trees this year, as in other years. In Japan, the persimmon is closely associated with the ancient capital of Nara, which we visited to explore its great complexes of temples, its vast gold Buddha, its tame deer and green parks. In Nara, they make a special sushi, salmon sliced and salted very lightly, and sake-infused rice, all wrapped in persimmon leaves. And the leaves, by the way, must face inward. The flavour is indescribable, says the Japanese writer Tanizaki, and far better than the sushi one gets in Tokyo. Now, my husband and our friend, who lives in Okayama, set off to climb a flight of steep stone steps up to a Shinto shrine. I sit at the foot of the steps, I've had enough climbing for one day, and look out across the persimmon orchards, the ripe fruits, the bowed branches. After a few minutes, a bell sounds from the shrine, out into the clear, windless afternoon. And now my husband and our friend reappear, and off we set again. I do not say what I was thinking as they sounded the bell, that I would like to have a persimmon tree in our garden in Dublin, maybe, someday, if persimmons even grow in Ireland. We leave Japan at length and go home. I buy a persimmon or two from time to time, and now they seem to mean more to me. The pleasure is more intense. And one day in February, the doorbell rings and a courier hands me a package, tall, slender, well wrapped. I open it and discover a persimmon tree, a sapling, sourced from an Irish nursery, a gift from our friend far away in Japan. It is tree planting season, and we set the sapling in a corner of the garden and think of the glowing persimmons to come.
On the corner of Prussia Street and St. Joseph's Road in Dublin is a structure whose terracotta paintwork is cracked, windows bordered up, rooftop sprouting foliage like hair. Out front, black shutters remain permanently closed. Above, a panel with gold lettering advertises the space's now redundant function. Lally newsagent. I live nearby, but for years didn't notice this building. Then, one day, there it was. I had recently been asked as a freelance journalist to write about the last independent corner shops in Dublin. I hopped on my bike and entered worlds of penny sweets, scratch cards, lemonade, fishing tackle, knitting needles, bread, milk, eggs, toilet roll, 2 for a fiver. Stalwart shopkeepers stood behind counters ringing up purchases. How many times in their lives had they said, "Hiya, thank you, card or cash?" I liked these people, rooted for their businesses, though they didn't seem half as fazed as I was that their retirement would spell the end of an era. It was natural, perhaps, that these outdated models would cease to be. There were franchises now, supermarkets, online shops. Lally Newsagent, with its tangled briars and rotting walls, came into focus for me then. It isn't the most impressive of ruins, but I was drawn to its haunted charm, the suggestion of life in the shutters that threatened to open any day now, business as usual. Looking at it, I saw another store, one I know very well, though I have never been inside. My grandparents owned this place, a small establishment on Townsend Street. College Deli was the name over the door. The first deli counter in Ireland, or so we like to say. To us, it was simply the shop. The shop was sold before I was born, but my mother and her siblings worked there in their youth. I picture them all, buttering slice after slice of bread. I think of the lunchtime rush, of my grandmother's sore feet, of the people of Dublin, nourished by their efforts. All sorts came and went. Professionals, students, professors, oddballs, elites. People ducking out of the rain of 1970s and 80s Dublin. The regulars were known by name. Even now, my mother will mention Mr. or Mrs. such and such, who used to come into the shop. Once, a woman came in and asked for half a cabbage. Frustrated at this strange request, my grandfather went to the other end of the counter, nudged my grandmother, and said, "That old bat wants half a cabbage." When he turned around, there was the woman. "And this lovely lady," he continued, with his signature quick wit, "would like the other half." When I write about independent corner shops, I am writing about the way things were, which is another way of looking at the way things are. I discover that corner shop is the wrong term. That's a British phenomenon. In Ireland, we had newsagents, and they were just that, agents to sell news. I record the downfall of these institutions, the relics, the ruins. As a journalist, I know that the demise I am seeing is that of my own profession. The last time I checked, my grandparents' shop on Townsend Street was a Japanese restaurant. I went in once, ate a plate of noodles. I wanted to talk to the owner, but I didn't know what to say. Outside, it was sunny. I remember looking across the road to the site that had formerly held the Screen Cinema, which I frequented as a student. Before that, it was the Theatre Royal, which my grandfather used to go to in his day. Hawkins House, which one Christmas had been occupied by activists protesting homelessness, had once stood nearby too. They were all gone. The site was a building site. I peered through the fence and saw a giant hole, making way for the foundations of an office block. I look up Lally, the news agent, but can't find any information. I have no memory of the store ever having been open. I'm sure there must be people living who have been inside, just as there must be people living who visited my grandparents' shop. A news agent is not a place that sticks in your memory. You come and you go. You get what you need. You forget having been. Around Dublin, I've started seeing other decaying former newsagents too. There's one on the corner of Berkeley Road and St. Vincent Street. Its signage, which once read Fruit Selections, has been altered with spray paint to say Derelictions. In the news, I read about closures. Not outdated old stores, but busy modern hotspots. An upmarket restaurant, a local cafe, a thrift store, a karaoke bar. On my walks, I pass the privileged pigeons of Dublin residing in the most beautiful buildings of the most sought-after areas. Town is dying, my friends say. We can feel it, the peculiar stillness. It is too expensive even to breathe. Is a city still a city if no one lives there? But people lived here once. I am sure of it. they dropped into my family shop. They might even have bought half a cabbage.
And I want to feel like I'm in charge, like an angry bull in a house of cards, and they'll all fall down when they don't take heed, 'cause I want what I don't need.
I have long considered myself the worst gardener ever. Despite my various attempts at creating a pastoral utopia, my garden, like a sullen lover, likes to decline my most ardent advances. Slips, cuttings, seeds simply never take in my care. My planting attempts fall foul of myriad misfortunes. My bulbs fail to ignite or get killed off by weather. I may spread layer upon layer of nourishing topsoil, but all it yields for me is a proliferation of dandelions. I overwater, I underwater. Too much shade, not enough sun. I plant too near the surface, too far below ground. Like Cavanagh's Monaghan, my soil proves grey and stony. If a plant does manage to survive, it's all too soon strangled by weeds or eaten by snails. How I rail at them as they chomp down their hearty breakfast of yellow dahlias. Eventually, over the years, my friends and family gave up gifting me pot plants because even these, with alarming speed, wither or droop despondently on my sills. This is all the more painful for me because green fingers run in our family, starting with my mother. Our garden, when I was growing up, was tiny but abundant, with fuchsia, pearly rose bushes and beguiling begonia. Earth-smelling geraniums, the Victorian symbol of respectability, glowed pinkly in shadowy corners. Multicoloured sweet pea climbed up netting, secured against the garden's back wall. Propped against that wall, an old door was deliberately placed, giving the impression of an entry point to mystery, a secret garden perhaps. Border flowers thrived. Clouds of lavender sent out their misty aroma near the front gate. In short, it provided a mini Eden for our two cats, Mary Lou and Ginger, the former being named after Joe Dolan's hit of that year, The House with the Whitewashed Gables. Meanwhile, the hanging gardens of Babylon are as nothing compared with my sister's lush, verdant vistas. Each sister knows the genus of every bulb or root, can reel off their Latin names too, and identify a bloom by scent from 100 paces. Migrating flowers from garden to garden, for them, is child's play. They energetically discuss the merits of the cold frame or the phosphorus value of bone meal, how to avoid the treachery of frost or protect against shell-armoured invaders. While feigning boredom, deep down envy flourished in me. Each time I glanced out my own kitchen window, a barren wilderness mocked me. My inner gardener despaired and shriveled. Even birds passing overhead showed discernment, donating their deposits elsewhere, perhaps guessing the inevitable outcome. After years of failed trips to garden centres and garden fetes, of following instructions, as I thought, to the letter, I'd all but given up my quest for gardening nirvana. Maybe I just couldn't follow instructions, or maybe I was following them too slavishly, trying too hard. Maybe gardens need to be wooed and coaxed, not controlled, I thought, as I did a bit of spring planting, with no real expectation. And then, this summer, out of the blue, I was rewarded with the miracle I'd long hoped for. A single magnificent poppy unfurled from its pod reminded me of a crushed ball gown unpacked from a debutante suitcase, layers of silkiest silk unfolded, revealing the most outrageous ruby red I'd ever seen. Purply black stamens provided startling contrast, paler shades like watermarks inside the petals. Then flourished more and more of them. Each time a pod shed its green jacket, the miracle renewed, each one more glamorous than the last. These glorious poppies took to my soil like no other plant, shrub or flower before them. Sturdy stems proved worthy scaffolding for such exotic beauties, especially if the occasional Irish summer squall tried to quench their flame. Summer at an end, my poppies dispersed their seeds in the generous winds of time, and some long slumbering instinct awoke in me, and I went out and deadheaded my tall beauties. And now, with winter upon us, my oriental poppies are experiencing a glorious late flowering. Because I had been prudent and pruned them back to ground level, proving that I may be more garden savvy than I thought, my poppies were able to regenerate without struggle, albeit on a more modest level. Have I finally earned the right to the green-fingered credentials of my tribe? Perhaps not quite yet, but my inner gardener is finally at peace.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago.
The box was about to be thrown on the skip. It had been found in the attic of a house in the County Down village of Rostrever and had belonged to a previous owner, a lady long deceased. The subsequent owner was doing a clear out some years later, and the box, which contained watercolour sketches, photographs, and two autograph books, would have to go. But a friend called Mary Claire Douglas, who was helping, said no, she would take it. She was an artist and liked the look of the watercolours. They were the work of that previous owner, whose name was Olive Swansea, and who had died in 1974 at the age of 92. Olive is still fondly remembered in Rostrever as a church-going single lady whose postcards and calendars depicting the nearby Mourne Mountains and the waters of Carlingford Lough were regularly sold at parish events. But as Mary Claire Douglas would later discover, what was truly astonishing among the contents of the box were the so-called autograph books. In page after page, there were poems, jokes, cartoons and sketches, all of them written and drawn by wounded soldiers in a field hospital at Rouen in France during World War I. They had clearly been encouraged to do so by their nurses, by Olive Swansea and her colleagues. People in Rostrever did know that Olive had served as a volunteer nurse, and every November, on Remembrance Day, she would arrange white crosses in the small front garden of her Georgian house near the village square. But none of her local friends, nor family relatives in England, knew anything about the box in the attic or the secrets it held. There are many secrets. There are over 100 contributors, English, Irish, Scots, American, Australian, South African. What they created give glimpses of the courage, the defiance, the fears of wounded men. Our friends in the trench or the way seem to know that we've come here to stay. They shoot and they shout, but they can't get us out, and there's no dirty trick they won't play. There's black humour too. In a cartoon, a soldier points his bayonet at a German backside. The caption, an attack from the rear by night. And there are thoughts of home and love. I remember the days I used to flirt with a nice young schoolgirl in a tango skirt. That was written by an Irish soldier who survived the war and went home to the family farm in County Sligo. His granddaughter remembers going with him on milk deliveries, but he never said he'd written anything. ever. It's only since the centenary of the war years began in 2014 that people in Rostreva have become aware of the Olive Swansea legacy. The material, which includes her own sketches of hospital tents in Rouen, has been donated to the Ulster Museum in Belfast. A play called The Box, written by Carlo Gabler, has been staged at the museum. It portrays Olive in her garden a few years after the war. The other character, invented by the author, is a gardener who is also a war veteran. After showing him some of the poems, she tells him she must live in the present, not that dark past. The collection must be burned in a bonfire. But he says no. It was for her and the other nurses that those men made the effort to write and draw. They would surely want her to hold on to what they did. Maybe not to look at, but to keep. So lock it all away, he tells her, in a box, out of sight. The Church of Ireland Church in Rostreva is only a short walk from the house where the box was indeed kept out of sight for so long. The Roll of Honour lists 139 local men and women who served in the war, 21 of whom were killed. Many of the soldiers in Olive Swansea's secret collection did not survive. Those who did, and survivors everywhere, would have identified with these lines written by one of them about the nurses in Rouen. When the days of war and strife are done, and you sit round your own fireside, your thoughts and memories will sure travel on, remembering the Sisters of Mercy.
The Shipping Lanes in Memory of Derek Mahon. It was getting dark when the wind dropped. Down on the shore, a shape flew low over the stirred up water. A late curlew. I thought I would like to hear that call when I am dying, to stay with me to the far shore. That is how we are, craving company. Down the coast, my ship is leaving harbour. Her lights are gold bars on the blue-black water. She moves along her path on the crowded highway, headed for Valparaiso. While history is passing overhead, your small craft slips through unseen.
On this morning's programme, we heard A Sheep Dip Saga by Peter Trent, Persimmon by Neil Hegarty, The Shop by Niamh Donnelly. Then there was Late Flowering by Eileen Casey. That was followed by The Box in the Attic by Dennis Toohey, and that was first broadcast on the centenary of the Armistice. And the final piece this morning was The Shipping Lanes in Memory of Derek Mahon, a poem by Mary O'Malley. The music this morning, we began with I Could Be So Good For You, the Minder theme tune by Dennis Waterman. Then Takeda, a Japanese lullaby by Akai Tori, Redbirds. I Want What I Don't Need by The Villagers was next. Then Where Have All the Flowers Gone by Peter, Paul and Mary. And the final piece, Somewhere a Voice is Calling by Arthur Tate, played on piano by Stephen Hoff. And Mary O'Malley's latest collection of poetry, The Shark Nursery, has recently been published by Carcanet Press. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.